With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 388th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a tech wizard, a thrice-published author, and a rising star in the world of comedy. For many people, 2020 was the worst year of their life, but for her, it was, at least in a professional sense, the best. Indeed, during the global pandemic, her do-it-yourself video shot at home in Brooklyn, featuring her lip-syncing and acting out then-President Donald Trump saying ridiculous things, went absolutely viral and won her plaudits from the likes of Jerry Seinfeld, Cher, and Kamala Harris, among many others. The Washington Post described her as just about the only good thing in a year mired in isolation, racial unrest, and political conflict. Adweek named her Digital Creator of the Year, and the Associated Press selected her as one of the year's five breakthrough entertainers. Now, she is being given the larger platform that she so richly deserves, including an Emmy-contending Netflix comedy special called Sarah Cooper, Everything's Fine. I'm talking, of course, about Sarah Cooper. Over the course of our conversation, the 44-year-old immigrant from Jamaica reflects on her decades-long struggle between doing the responsible thing and pursuing the performing arts that she so loves, how she arrived at and then walked away from a tremendous career at Google in order to focus on comedy, what led her to turn to TikTok to mock Trump, and why she thinks her videos resonated with people in a way that other Trump impersonations perhaps did not, what she hopes the unusual sort of pandemic-era fame that she attained will yield in the years to come, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to have you. And to begin with, on this podcast, we always just cover a few basics. Can you share with our listeners where you were born and raised and what your folks did for a living?
Hi, Scott. Nice to be here. Such a deep question to start out with. Wow. I was born in Jamaica, but I was raised in Rockville, Maryland. And my dad was an engineer for the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority.
Okay.
And my mom was a human resources director for a health consulting firm. And now, they're both retired now, so.
Nice. And they deserve it, right? Because you had a bunch of siblings, I believe, right?
Yeah, two older sisters and one older brother.
Okay, yeah. So how, by the time you came along, were they spent or were they extra attentive?
Yeah, I have no idea why they went ahead with me. I feel like maybe they probably weren't planning on me because they had their hands full with my sisters and my brother. So, yeah, but then, you know, I came along and they were like, oh, wow, glad we tried again.
Yeah. So it's been fun prepping for this, obviously, by going back through your various visual content, but also just reading about, you know, your story, which I guess the thing that really stood out to me the most about your earlier years was that you were, I think, drawn to the arts, it sounds like, as a kid, but took a long detour. And I guess I just wondered, there was something that happened at 17, I guess almost a communication with yourself. What was the context around that, if you can just share? Because it sounds like it's always been a tug of war for you about whether or not to go down this route.
Yeah, it has. I mean, you know, as many immigrant will attest to, when you come to this country, you come here for the opportunity to be either a businessman, a lawyer, or a doctor. Those are the three options. So it's really hard to go to your parents, who are, you know, Jamaican immigrants who work very hard, and say, I want to act. You know, it's just not what they want to hear, because they want you to own a house and get married and settle down and have, you know, be financially independent. I'm at my parents' house right now. Every night my dad talks to me about taxes, indexed annuities, 401k. I still don't really understand any of it, even though I have a degree in economics, which I got because my parents didn't want me to get a theater degree. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at 17, I was going to go off to college, and I got a theater scholarship and really wanted to do theater. And my parents were very, I would say, they encouraged me to not do that, or at least have some kind of backup so that I wouldn't be struggling. And I felt it was necessary for me to not let myself down and not let my own dreams down. And so I created a contract between me and myself where I said, I, Sarah Cooper, being of sound mind and body, and I didn't even realize that sound mind was one phrase. I put a comma after sound. So I was like, Sarah Cooper, of sound, comma, mind, and body.
I'm glad you are a sound.
Yeah, I was totally of sound.
Yeah.
I promised myself to, try to be an actress for at least 10 years, or, you know, as long as it takes, or if I decide to change my mind and I don't want that anymore, that's fine too. But I just promised myself that I would give it a try. And so I signed the contract. I had my sister witness it, because I am so business that I had a witness. Okay, this was, I can't even believe I didn't sign it in blood. I mean, I was so serious about this thing. And I signed this contract to myself, and I still have it. I just came across it the other day, actually.
So in your mind at that point, what that would mean was that I'm going to use this theater scholarship to University of Maryland, go there instead to spend my undergrad years, as you've just, you know, said, doing economics, but that somewhere along the line, these years are going to be made up for with, in terms of acting, somewhere down the road.
Yeah, it was just always in the back of my head, like, you know, I'm going to get this degree. But, you know, I sent my picture to a casting director. I worked, you know, as an intern at Central Casting for a little bit. I was always just had my like one little toe in theater. I did a, you know, production at the University of Maryland, and, you know, went eventually found design because it was creative. But I could also make money, which was like, oh, the two things, I can be creative and I can also make money. But, you know, I also really did like design. I really like being, on a laptop. I have this story about, you know, my first job as a designer, and they gave me an office on my first day. I was making like $25,000 a year, and I had my own office, and I was so excited about this office. And I think most actors will tell you that the thought of sitting in an office all day like kills them, but right. It didn't kill me. I was like, oh my God, I have an office. I have a desk. I have a boss. Like, I was really excited about the whole thing. So, I think that was the thing about it. It was like, yeah, I really wanted to act, but I could see myself working in a job like that. And I did it for a long time, and I had fun and I was good at it. So, I think that was the thing that was hard, was that I did have this passion, but then I was also good at other things, you know?
Well, it sounds like the key discovery while you're at University of Maryland was Photoshop.
Yes, I discovered Photoshop, multimedia design. Remember when they called it multimedia?
Yeah. And yeah. So this, just when you talk about, you know, that you went on and had, you know, some jobs in design after college, this was, I guess, how would you, more specifically, like what kind of stuff were you involved with as you acquire these skills in college, now you go out into the real world with your economics degree, you're going to put it to work doing this stuff. What were you doing?
Well, I got a master's degree in design at Georgia Tech, and then I got a job as an interactive designer at an ad agency. So I was like a little Don Draper, making flash
Peggy.
Ads.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Don Draper making flash ads? That's what I was doing. I would, you know, those ads that would come up, like if you went to RottenTomatoes.com and those ads that would come up and take over your whole screen and you can find the X button, like that's what I was working on.
Oh, thanks so much for those. Really appreciate those.
The harder it was to find the X button, the more money I made. So.
Oh, well, you must have done very well.
Yeah. I was just in Flash all the time, just making animated ads and, you know, animated experiences. And that's what I did. That was my first thing.
And we shouldn't like downplay it though. It sounds like you were a pretty incredible student and then person in that field, right? I mean, you were a creative director at a design firm at what age?
I was a creative director at 25, 26.
Which is a big deal. And and so could you at that point have imagined that this was going to be the rest of your life, or was it still nagging at you that, you know, I still have this itch to do more with performing arts?
Yeah, I think that contract to myself just never went away. Like it was always there. And even though I, you know, after I left that job and I went to Yahoo and was designing there, it was just always in the back of my head that there was something I promised myself and there was something I felt like I was born to do and I wasn't doing it. And I remember being at that job, and I started acting. I was taking classes while at that ad agency, and I got a job to be a maid in some print ad, and it was paying like $6,000 for one day of work, and so I had to do it. It was like so much money, but then I just like blew off work, and I almost got fired, but then I didn't get fired, thankfully. But yeah, I was doing things like that where it was just like kind of sort of living a double life, you know?
Right. So what brought about your move to New York, which was a big, big thing along the way?
Yeah, I moved to New York when I was 32, and I had just tried stand-up comedy in Atlanta for the first time. And then I was in the Estella Adler Conservatory for a summer study, and I was probably one of the oldest people in that group. It was all like 20-year-olds, and I just felt like so over the hill at 32. I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? And then I just fell in love with New York. So I ended up staying.
I want to come back to the stand-up part of that conversation in a moment, but just in terms of day-to-day living, was it also because you had, was Google in New York?
Yeah, Google was in New York, but I moved to New York pretty I moved to New York just for the summer. I was going to go back to Atlanta, and then I decided to stay because I really liked it there. And tried to do freelance design and stand up and audition at the same time. And then immediately was like, wow, I have a $20,000 credit card bill and I can't afford to live here. So that's when I ended up at a dead end job at Google.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, most people would love to have that be their fallback. So in this case, though, it was because you had really distinguished yourself at I guess the most previous thing would have been Yahoo, where you were now going from, I guess, what exactly were you doing at Yahoo? And then what were you brought to Google to do?
Interactive design. I mean, it's all kind of, but I guess I wasn't really making ads anymore. I was more doing interfaces. And so at Google, I was doing the, you know, Google Docs slides and sheets. So that was my thing, and designing the interface. So people are like, oh, what does that mean to design the interface? I mean, it basically means like if you open up Google Docs and you start to type, like I decided how much of a shadow there should be around the page. I decided like what the icons were, what order of the icons. Like basically I just copied Microsoft all day. That's all I did. I was like, what's Microsoft Word doing? Okay, let's do that. But we didn't do exactly that, but it's basically all of anything that you see, anything that you click on, anything that you read on the interface, that's what I was working on.
And that's a huge deal. That's like that you had a whole team. Like they don't just bring in a, you know, somebody who they don't really believe in and give them that that kind of responsibility, right? So it seems like you're a star in that field, and yet even that level of success, and I don't know what the compensation, I imagine might have been good, all that stuff, you were just nothing was going to make that be enough, right? It seems like.
Yeah. I mean, when I got the job at Google, I was at a red carpet premiere for one of these independent films that I had been doing. Like, it was a red carpet premiere at, I think, at like a strip mall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like at a movie theater at a strip mall. And that was like, and I was like all dressed up like I was in Hollywood. My mom was there. I had a boyfriend who was there. And I got the call like pretty much when I was about to go in and watch this movie that I was in. And I had to accept it because I was in debt and I wanted to stay in New York. And I really felt like at that point, okay, I've given up my dream for the 18,000th time. So this must be it. And and you're right. I mean, when you look at Google, it's one of the best places to work in the world, you know, free food, you know, there's so many perks and it's just an amazing place to work. And yet for me, it was like, well, you know, I'm giving up my dream once again to do this.
So to go back to Atlanta, which is, I guess, that was, what company was it in Atlanta? That was pre-Yahoo, right?
It was called IQ Interactive.
Okay. So while you're there doing that, you mentioned that, I guess that's where stand-up was first tried. What led you to do that? Had you always known that you had a sort of comedic inclination, or it sounds like you were going to be happy performing in any, it wasn't a comedy specific thing until then, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was not good at acting. I really was failing a lot. I was auditioning for things over and over and over again. And just really wasn't getting anywhere. And I started to, I'm the type of person where like, I try to figure it out. I'm like, what's missing? What can I do? Like, what's the thing that's, you know, not working. And so I really took every class. I've taken literally every class you can imagine. if there's a class for it, I'll take it. And so I took writing, I took singing, I took acting classes, I took scene work, I took improv, I took sketch, I took everything. And then the one thing I hadn't tried was stand up. And it was just one of these things where I was like, well, you know, I was starting to realize that being a character is not really about becoming this other thing. It's really about finding that character in yourself. And I really wasn't in touch with myself. And I would just get this feedback constantly, which was, Sarah, like when I talk to you, you're so animated and you're so like, you know, exciting and engaging and all of these things. But then when you try to like act and be a character, you lose it all. You become a robot. Like all of the interesting things you do when you are you just go away. And it was just me sort of, I'm kind of like a perfectionist, like people pleaser kind of thing. And like, I started to realize like, that's not interesting to watch. You never want to watch an actor who like, you know exactly what they're going to do. You want to watch an actor who surprises you and does something that like you didn't see coming. And even now I just started watching Outlander and like the main actor, I don't know his name, but you know, I started to realize when you watch people, you almost internally try to predict what they're going to do always. We're constantly doing that. And when they do something that you didn't expect, you love it. You're like, oh, I didn't see that coming. And I did the opposite of that. I was always like, I'm going to be as predictable as possible. I'm going to do everything exactly right. And it's just not fun to watch. And so I think the stand-up was like my way of trying to capture or try to get in touch with like, what is it about me, you know, and being me that I can put into acting and like, you know, but then I just found that I really liked writing for myself and I really liked being myself. And so, and then I really liked being funny. That was really what I wanted to do because before I was like, how do I cry? How do I cry? Mm-hmm. Like I need to cry. Like that's what actors do, cry. But I love laughing and I really had to just find that and admit that to myself.
So when you now move from Atlanta to New York, the stand-up, was that an ongoing thing?
Yeah. I mean, I was doing stand-up while I was like, you know, working at Google and, you know, inviting my coworkers to shows and which actually worked out because, you know, the 2-drink minimum, a lot of people at Google can totally afford that. So
yes.
I did stand-up actually at our Google offsites. I did stand up at the Google Talent Show. I came in second or third behind this guy who was a beatboxer. so yeah, I was just doing it whenever I could and just thought, well, it's just something that's fun. And it was just always, it kind of replaced acting for me. And it was just like, oh, how can I get good at this thing? You know?
So is it correct that another kind of form of comedy that really interested you and I guess a particular version of it, a person of it would have been the Colbert Report?
Yes, very much so. Wow, you've really done your research, Scott. Yeah, I feel like you could just tell my whole, you could just interview yourself as me. It'll be fine.
I'll lip sync you.
Yeah. Yeah, I just loved Stephen Colbert because he became the thing that he didn't like. He like really became the thing that he became the thing that he wanted to make fun of. And I just found it so fascinating, and he was so good at it. So that's something I would like watch his monologues. I would write them down. I would like transcribe them. I would study the jokes and try to write my own and create my own sort of Stephen Colbert character. And I was just fascinated with it.
So is the Colbert report.
Yeah, I know.
Responsible for the creation of a blog called the Cooper Review.
Yes. Yes.
And so what was that? That was just while you're at Google, a outlet to do written comedy?
Yeah. I was at Google for about 3 years when I wrote 10 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, which I had started writing when I was at Yahoo, but then I just never did anything with it. And then I published it finally, and it went viral. And that was the first thing that I did that ever went viral. And so I created the blog based on the success of that one article.
Can you tell people, if they haven't seen it yet, what was that article about? Because it really did catch on in a big way.
Yeah, it did. It's still going. It's it's basically just I noticed that people would just do things in meetings to make it look like they knew what they were doing, even when they were not paying attention at all. And the first thing I noticed was a guy got up and drew a Venn diagram. And the Venn diagram just made no sense. And I, trying to predict what would happen, I was thinking to myself, everyone's going to tell him that this is completely irrelevant and he needs to sit down. But people were like, oh, a Venn diagram. Oh, this is interesting. And everyone started trying to make the Venn diagram more accurate and all this stuff. And he just sat back down and went back to his laptop. He didn't even pay attention the rest of the meeting. And I wrote down in my notebook how to look smart in a meeting, draw a Venn diagram. And I think this same guy, a few meetings later, somebody was giving a presentation and said, you know, 25% of people clicked on this button. And he said, oh, about 1 in 4. And everyone was like, oh, 1 in 4. Yeah. And everybody was so impressed, even though he didn't actually add in any information. And so.
Well, you were saying another version of that was always like, let's talk about how to scale this, right?
Right, right. Another one is, will this scale? Just ask if it's going to scale, no matter what it is. All of these tricks, you know, let's ask if we can take a step back here, you know. Pace around the room is a great one. You don't even have to say anything. Just pace around and people think, wow, you're really considering this very carefully, whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah.
So this blog post, it seems like it led to a whole bunch of things. What were the, in your memory, how did that all unfold, the next few things?
Yeah, I mean, I started the Cooper Review. I, you know, got a few interviews on TV and about it. And then I left Google and I didn't really have a book deal, but I don't know, I thought maybe it could become a book. So I turned it into an illustrated post and I republished it and it went viral again. And that's when it got the attention of publishers. And I found my agent, Susan Rayhoffer, and she's still my agent now. And I said, you know what, I want to turn this into a book. And she said, you know what, we're going to turn this into 3 books. That's the kind of literary agent you want.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we turned it into 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, which was the first book. And then I did a coloring book for business people where you can like color in low hanging fruit and someone getting thrown under the bus and things like that. And then my third book, How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings, which came out in 2018. Yeah.
And which I believe is going to be the next Sarah Cooper related screen project we see probably.
We shot a pilot. Unfortunately, CBS passed on it.
They passed on it?
Yeah, they did.
And somebody can, is that now proprietary or can somebody else buy it if they want it?
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for. We're hoping to shop it to other places, but we got to shoot a pilot with Natalie Morales and Amy Landecker and Bradley Whitford. I mean, it was just an amazing cast.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
well, I don't want to get too far. Well, you know, we'll come back to, you know, what's coming up for you, but I guess now in the midst of, so you leave Google, I think 2014, you're, as you say, you're embarking on this writing career,
Well, the book, 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, came out October 2016. In November 2016, the worst thing in the world ever happened. I'm sure everybody remembers. And so
yes.
I had a lot of things like lined up to try to promote. I thought that book was going to change my life. I was going to be a millionaire, and it just didn't happen. And I just felt really sad about it. And so, yeah, that was the first time. That was the first thing that happened.
Well, and you're teeing it up perfectly for what I wanted to ask you about, which was November 26th, whatever it was, I think November 3rd, 2016. I think 99% of us didn't see it coming, what we ended up with. It was upsetting enough to me as, you know, a straight white male from the United States. I wonder for you as a woman of color who was, you know, immigrated at a young age to this country from one of the places that this guy's now. I mean, some of the first things he was doing were going after immigrants, calling majority black country shithole countries, all of that. Before you were ever mobilized to figure out how you could take this on, just how did you personally respond to this jarring development?
It was excruciating. I mean, it was really, I experienced all the emotions over the course of that year. At first, I thought it was so funny that he was running. It was the most hysterical thing in the world. I even bought a Trump t-shirt because I thought, oh, this is going to be worth something because this is never happening.
Right.
And then once I started realizing, oh no, people are actually taking him seriously. And then, oh wow, he actually might have a chance. And I remember feeling about 3 weeks before the election, like he might actually win. And I woke up like crying because I was like, I think he's going to win. And I remember being on Twitter the day of the election. And I think I tweeted something about how, like, I have bad feeling, you know, mm-hmm. And so many people wrote, Sarah, 99%. There's no way. There's absolutely no way this is happening. And then it happened. And that night I didn't sleep, and it was so sad. I was on a plane the next day watching Hillary Clinton's speech and crying on the plane. And I was just, I didn't know. It's kind of like when you see an earthquake, you know how sometimes they say you see an earthquake and you see the earth like move in a way that it's not supposed to move, like the streets wave. It's like, nothing made sense. It was like up was mm-hmm. down was up. Nothing made sense. I didn't know. You know, and it's like all the people that are the conspiracy theorists were over there. And then all of a sudden I was one of them, you know, we just swapped places, you know, all of a sudden I was like, wait, what's happening? What does this mean? What's going on? You know, I got very paranoid. I got very angry.
Well, I was going to say there's stages of grief, I guess, you know, and in this case, you know, your first interaction with Trump online was well before you were making any videos, right? What happened in October 2017, which wasn't a joke, but it was...
Right.
Anyway, let me let you take that
yeah,
away.
Yeah, yeah. I was one of his reply guys, I guess. You know, I was always replying to his tweets and telling him what an idiot he was. Because mm-hmm. I really felt like, you know, I was doing my civic duty.
I was right there with you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just tweeted something about how, like, fake news, Trump is not fit for presidency, and real news, Trump was never fit for the presidency or something. Just really stupid and innocuous. And but I guess people started liking it and retweeting it, and he saw it, and then he blocked me. And it was just like, oh my God, I've been blocked by the president of the United mm-hmm. States, which was a huge claim to fame at the time.
Yes, I was always like, please, it would make my life so much better if this asshole would just block me. but so that's 2016, he gets elected. 2017, you get blocked. 2018, your book, How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings, comes out. And then I guess, was it in 2019 or somewhere along then? When did TikTok first cross your radar? Just the existence of it.
It was August 2019. I went to go hang out with my nephews in Maryland and trying to bond with my little Ryan and Tyler. and so I was like, show me TikTok. And I installed it on my phone and we made a few videos. And I was like, oh, that was fun, little bonding. But they were like, Aunt Sarah, you're too old for this, you know. you know. And so I just kind of put it away and didn't really think about it again.
I guess what was it then that, people, I think that your first Trump lip syncing one to go viral was How to Medical. But in fact, there were, I believe, several, you know, attempts that didn't go viral before that to do similar stuff. What even, let's just say for the first one of those, what made you turn to that medium as a outlet for, I mean, even just the idea of lip syncing anywhere, but particularly on TikTok? How did that come about?
Well, I was playing around TikTok when we were locked down in quarantine, and I was trying to do a dance, and bad, very bad at that. You know, making little videos, little sketches here and there. And then I saw a woman lip sync him. And I think it was, the quote was, it might get bigger, it might get smaller, but whatever. And it was something stupid that he said. And I saw this woman lip sync, and I was like, wow, that is fascinating. Like, it's fascinating hearing his voice coming out of someone else that looks nothing like him and who mm-hmm. isn't him. And I was like, I got to try that. I think the first one I did was maybe when he was just talking about companies or something like that. He was just one of these press conferences where he just listed companies. That's all he did for an hour is list companies. And so I made a little video with that. And then I think another one where I think that it really clicked for me, one where I was listening to one of his press conferences, and he said something about, well, somebody asked him how he was going to get something done. And he said, well, you know, I'm going to form a committee. Yeah, I'll call it a committee. And we're going to make decisions, and we're going to make decisions fairly quickly. And I think they're going to be the right decisions. And I was like, I felt like I was back in one of those meetings.
I was just going to say.
I felt like I was back in one of those meetings, and a guy who said absolutely nothing was being lauded and applauded and told he was brilliant for saying absolutely nothing. And mm-hmm. I got that because I'm a woman and a person of color and an immigrant. I got that little jealous feeling of just like, I want to do that. I want to say nothing and have people think I'm amazing, you know? So, I mean, that was the first instinct of just like, yeah, I'm just this guy in a meeting and I'm just saying nothing and, you know, but it's me doing it.
Right.
And it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
And so what I think maybe distinguished How to Medical, which is now April 2020, just like a month into the pandemic, what distinguished that one from those earlier attempts was it had a little more production value?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, you know, I played a character reacting to him, which came from the audio because you hear him go, we're going to check that, right? You know, you hear him saying like, yeah, we're going to check that. And I listened to it and I immediately saw the person on the other side going, what the fuck are you talking about?
This is where he's talking about injecting disinfectant, right? And yeah, Deborah Birx is just like crapping herself. Yeah.
Right. We're going to put light inside the body, you know, and we haven't tried that yet, but we're going to test that. Right. And the other thing is we can put, you know, disinfectant, you know, cause it knocks it out, you know, in a minute, it'll just knock it out.
Right. Which he then later claimed he was joking, which he does not joke. So tell me about, you put that up on, I think I had read it was like a Thursday night or something.
Yeah.
You go to sleep maybe and wake up. And what's the first indication that you're dealing with something unexpected here?
It was, you know, it had a million views.
Overnight?
A day. Yeah, I think next day. Yeah, I think it had a million views and it was going crazy viral. And I'd made a few videos that went kind of viral before, and then I'd had other things go viral. So I just really thought, oh, cool. Yay. Success. I made a viral video in the pandemic. You know, that was really, it's so much fun going viral. It's really just, it's nice when you make something and a bunch of people see it and a bunch of people like it. So I didn't really think, I mentioned it to my manager at the time. I was like, oh my God, this is going viral. And he was like, cool. Like he didn't even think it was a big deal. And so I was like, oh, I guess maybe it's actually not that big of a deal. And then I think Jerry Seinfeld started talking about it. And that was like, whoa, Jerry Seinfeld's talking about it. So I told that to my manager, and he was like, cool. I'm like, okay, I guess it's really not a big deal. So I just thought it was like a one and done, kind of like one of those, you know, amazing things that happens and then go away. But then the pandemic kept going on and he kept saying dumb shit. And I just kept making videos because it was just fun.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, let's just note that as you continue doing these, and I'm just going to mention a few titles that may provoke memories for people. How to People, Woman, Man, Camera, TV. How to Bunker. How to TikTok, which gets meta. But obviously, the following's growing. Everybody's still locked down at home. And I'm just going to mention a few things. You mentioned Jerry Seinfeld commenting. Also, share. I understand that people like George Conway are DMing with special requests for videos. At some point, Kamala Harris wants to get in touch. Then the late night stuff begins where you end up filling in for Kimmel, right? And being on some of these others. But I wondered for you experiencing this, you were like the rest of us locked down in a deadly pandemic. And if you went outside, you, I believe, wore a mask. And so presumably people weren't recognizing or approaching you in real life. So was it sort of almost like a fever dream that this world has changed when you're in front of your computer? But in any other sense, the ways that you would normally feel that you've broken through in this way, it probably wasn't happening, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I did Ellen from my couch. I did Fallon from my couch. You know, a lot of it was, you know, still at home. And yeah, I would go out and wear a mask. I think the first time I got recognized, I had taken my mask down for some reason to pick up my dog's poop. And this little girl was like, are you Sarah Cooper? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm Sarah Cooper. Do you watch my videos? And she was like, no, my dad watches them. And I was like, oh, cool, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I did like a photo shoot in the neighborhood, and then a few people came by and were just like, thank you. Like everyone said was just thank you. When they did recognize me, it was just like, thank you so much. And I still get that all the time. Like, you got me through, And it just makes me feel so good. But I went from 60,000 Twitter followers to 2.3 million. You know, it's a crazy amount of, it just snowballed. But at the same time, I just have no concept. I still feel like I don't know what happened. Like I was, you know, doing a Zoom with Ben Stiller, and I was just like, is this happening? Like, it just, none of it felt real. You know, none of it felt like it was really happening. And I've met all these amazing people and all this stuff, but it's still, people are like, you're Sarah Cooper. And I'm like, I don't really feel like anything's really changed that much. You know what I mean?
Well, and even your special, which of course we're going to come to, I mean, it had to be made under the most bizarre of circumstances. So I guess it's like you are the case study in essentially becoming famous when nobody can go outside and what that is like. But I guess I have to ask about was there any of the flip side where, you know, clearly there are more than a few Trumpers who are a little unhinged. Have you felt any of that coming in your direction?
Knock on wood, I haven't. You know, even when Trump himself was asked about my videos, he just was like, yes. I don't know who she is. What are you talking about? So, I mean, honestly, I think there was more of a backlash from people who were like, I don't know, like, Sarah Cooper, she's just lip syncing, you know, she's not funny, you know, she's like, I think I was called like a boomer comedian because boomers love me, and which is true, boomers do love me. And I think there was more of a backlash from just like, people thinking I did nothing and I came out of nowhere and I didn't deserve like what I was getting. I think there was more of a backlash on that than there was from Trumpers. I would literally get people who were Trump supporters saying, I love Trump, but this is funny. Like they were, they thought it was funny too. So I really didn't get the backlash that my dad was even like, you know, I don't want to get deported, you know, like he was scared that maybe there would be some huge backlash against me or something like
that. Well, I mean, I guess the key is that you were literally just using his own words. You're not projecting editorial comment beyond the stuff that we're going to, you know, come to. But I guess one other question is, here you are with your video content blowing up. I think initially, was it exclusively on TikTok? Then it goes beyond there. But like, TikTok is not monetizable. Twitter is not monetizable. For all this happiness that you're bringing the people who you're doing these for and the skill with which you did it, what could you actually personally kind of gain from it beyond hoping that it would lead to something like what it ultimately, I guess, with Netflix or things that came around? It wasn't like, I can't imagine, a hugely profitable venture in and of itself, was it?
No, I wasn't making any money. I mean, I was making a little money on YouTube ads, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. I would put the videos on YouTube, but yeah, I wasn't. I was really just doing it for fun, and then eventually, I was doing it because people were demanding it, and I was like, okay, yes, people need these.
Now, when Trump himself targeted TikTok and was like, "We're going to shut this down," there were some people out there who thought maybe he secretly is watching you and feels like that's the way to deal with it. I mean, that is a Trumpian way of handling things. Let's just take down the whole platform. It wouldn't have worked because I guess by that point you were already working beyond TikTok and the 60-second requirements. But what did you make of that he started going after TikTok?
I think it was also the TikTokers who disrupted his rally and made sure that nobody showed up. I think a lot of people thought it was that as well. When someone said my name to his face in that interview, that was a scary moment. That was like, mm-hmm. Whoa, he actually has heard, at least I know he's heard my name, which I didn't like. I didn't like that part. I didn't think he was going to shut it down because of me or whatever. I just thought it was ridiculous, but so on brand for him to do that.
Yes. So if we can kind of dissect like what made these things really click with people. I mean, there were obviously numerous other people who did Trump impersonations, some of which I thought were pretty good. You know, Alec Baldwin had his moments. There's this guy who I'm sure you've probably seen on social media, J.L. Coven, I thought was very good.
He hates me.
He hates you? Why?
He did this whole interview about how it was really frustrating the attention I was getting for just, you know, lip syncing him, whereas he was doing improv and like adding his own and writing his own stuff. And so, yeah.
I've never really talked to him,
but I think he felt he was kind of like a little sour.
He was bittered about it. Well, my only point in bringing up these other examples is, you know, it was interesting to see these white guys doing it, but to again see Trump's words coming out of somebody who in a lot of ways is his exact opposite, man versus woman, old versus young, white versus black, idiot versus educated person. In some ways, I guess, how do you think that affected the viewer experience? It just seems like in some ways it's like the ultimate insult to him to be mocked by his exact opposite, right?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think it's one thing to be played by Alec Baldwin, who is kind of, you know, I wouldn't say Alec Baldwin is Trump, but he's sort of a contemporary, like he's got the power, he's got the money, he's not an idiot, you know, but he's got all of that going for him. Whereas with me, I don't have the people calling me sir and like people, you know, following me around telling me I'm a genius or whatever. And so for me, I think it just kind of highlights how people said that they were actually able to hear what he was saying when it was coming out of my mouth. And the reason is because we're so visual that when we see a man, a powerful white man, rich in a suit, and people are nodding around him, we think, yeah, this must make sense because all of these things sort of add up to power and money and, like, you know, what I look up to or whatever. So coming out of my mouth, I think it was just like, you know, for better or worse, when a black woman is talking, we're like, wait, what's she saying? I bet she's lying. Like, what's she really saying? And I think I think people just listened a little bit more, which was great because it's like, he's not saying anything. Like, look, can we all just agree? And I think for a lot of people, it was like so cathartic, like, oh, I'm not crazy. He does sound ridiculous. He is an idiot. He is the worst president we've ever had. He is incompetent, you know? Mm-hmm. And somebody called it like the antidote to gaslighting, which I thought was like a brilliant way to describe it because he's gaslighting us constantly. And we're kind of, a lot of people are just kind of taking it. But then when it's out of my mouth, you're like, no, that actually doesn't make any sense. And I can actually see that now. And I can hear that pretty clearly now.
So do you think, though, I mean, had TikTok been around when George W. Bush was president and was also regularly saying stupid things with great confidence, would this same thing have had the same effect? Or is there something specific about Trump?
Wow. Now I want to go lip sync George Bush. That's such a great idea. I think it would have. I think it would be the same thing, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what does it tell us about you that you have in some ways gravitated towards and really succeeded tremendously in areas that are primarily dominated by the guy, the kind of person who you're saying, you know, is essentially your exact opposite? I mean, technology is a heavily white male, you know, industry, comedy. Now you're coming into Hollywood, which we are well aware of has its own issues. What is there something you think that maybe subconsciously draws you to that?
Yeah, I'm a masochist. I hate myself. I had this joke about, like, I think on the inside, I'm just like a white dude named Craig, you know, like I, because I love Bob Marley. You know, I work in tech. I did stand up comedy. So I don't know what it is, but I think for some reason maybe it's just growing up, being an immigrant, and just feel like, I think the moment I moved here, even though I was 3 years old, I was immediately like, how do I fit in? How do I fit in here? And I think that turned on my observational skills. And it was all like sort of self-preservation of just like, how can I make it look like I know what I'm doing the way that everyone else looks like they know what they're doing. And so a lot of that is, what are white men doing? Because white men sort of are in charge in this country for the most part. And so I think that's what happened. And, you know, as an immigrant, I just observed, and then I just imitated.
So when you think back to your childhood, which I sort of gloss over, go right from where you were born to your contract at 17, but had your childhood growing up in, you know, growing up as a young black girl in Rockville, is this a diverse community?
I was one of very few black people in my classes growing up. Yeah.
So had you, prior to entering the academic or corporate worlds, had you encountered bullshit related to race, or was it really only as an adult?
No, I mean, I was getting asked, what are you? From, you know, when I was like 8 or 7, you know, I didn't really know what I was. My best friend growing up was Jewish. She still is. And her name's Stacy. And, you know, we were walking home, and some white high school kids drove by and yelled out the N-word. And I thought they were talking to her. I didn't even know, you know what I mean? Because when you come to this country as an immigrant, and we came from a very diverse, Jamaica is so diverse. My grandmother's Chinese. My other grandmother is German. Like, we're all very mixed. And you come here, and then all of a sudden you're just black. And it's like, we as immigrants, we don't even really know what that means. And
well, you have a good joke about, I think, being at the mall with your dad, right?
Right. Yeah. Like, I was at the mall with my dad and he's like, look at those black people over there. And I'm like, Dad, that's a mirror, you know, because he's, his concept of how he's being seen and how he sees people are it's just completely, right. you know, defined by America in a way that he doesn't understand, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the upside of this was obviously, I would imagine that you're finally, after all these years of trying to just keep a foot in performing while doing what you have to do to, you know, pay the bills and just like everybody else, here you're finally being recognized and applauded in a major, major way for your abilities. And yet, was there any part of you that was concerned like, wait a minute, I have become so well known as the young woman who lip syncs Trump that that will be all I'm known for? Or what if he loses, which would obviously on one level be great, but then what happens to me then? Or where, like, how did, was any of that did you have time to even think about like what comes after this?
I think because I had, you know, written those books, I kind of knew that there were other things that I could do. I knew that. And there was no world in which I was going to be disappointed if he lost, like no world in hell.
Right.
Would I
right,
ever, right. like, I was so happy that he lost. And I'm, you know, I would even give up everything for him to have never been president. I would give it all up because it's not worth it. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tough thing because something magical did happen when I was doing those videos. And so I think it is a thing of, well, how do I find something magical like that again? You know, and I hopefully I will find something else like that. Or so one of these many projects I'm working on will be something else magical. But I look at it as just a very special thing that I was able to do that actually brought me a lot of great things. And so I'm happy about that. But I don't miss him. Although sometimes when I see, you know, he's still talking at Mar-a-Lago about, you know, the recount and stuff, you know, once in a while I'll watch a video, especially that call where he's asking the Atlanta commissioner to like, I really wanted to do that. I was tempted as hell to do that call. And so I listened to the whole thing. I lip synced the whole thing just to myself in private, you know, but yeah, I don't want to just be associated with the person I hate the most in the world. I mean, that's the toughest thing is that like my success will forever be tied to the person who's like one of the worst people who's ever existed. And so that's tough, but I think hopefully we can move on from it.
Well, and I mean, the fact is that this Netflix special was one of the, I guess, first things that was allowing you to take that and use it towards other things. And I just want to point out, as we'll have also done in the intro, but just this is a Netflix special under an hour. People can knock it out really quickly and it's fun. Produced by Maya Rudolph and Natasha Lyonne, directed by Natasha. So many star cameos centering on you as this news anchor who is reporting on and experiencing our descent into hell in this year in which everything bad hits at once. And I guess I just want to ask, I mean, so when along the line did this come about? Because it's been such a quick turnaround. This came out or dropped on October 27th, right before the election. This whole, your first videos were in April of 2020. So we're talking about April, May, June, July, August, September, October, 7 months from first video to Netflix special.
Yeah, insane. I would not advise anyone else to attempt to do what we did because, you know, it was a lot of people's first production back from being, you know, in lockdown. It was my first production ever. It was my time. I was on set. The last time I was on set, I think I was like, you know, I had a line on some show like years ago or whatever. I think it was Vampire Diaries or something like that. And now I was number one on the call sheet. Like, and now there were like 100 people with tags that said Sarah Cooper on it. It was so surreal. And I'm proud of everyone who worked on it and proud of what we were able to do. We were doing all of the writing on Zoom. We were doing all of the meetings on Zoom. We had all these strict COVID protocols, and it was all brand new for everybody. And for us to have done it, written it, produced it, direct, you know, all of that stuff without anyone getting sick, it was an incredible, incredible feat.
But even the fact that it existed at all, it seems like it was because you, among your many fans, were people like Maya and Natasha, yeah, right, who were saying this should not be a one-off thing. Like, she deserves a greater platform, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Maya Rudolph said to me, "Oh, I'm so excited about this special. I love when good things happen to good people." And she had known me for a week when she said that. And I was like, "You don't even know me, but thank you so much." And yeah, I mean, they're Maya and Natasha and Danielle Renfrew were amazing to work with.
Yeah.
I guess, a lot of people just think I'm a really nice person. I don't know why, but.
Well, and so to make this thing happen in that shorter time frame, you were writing on it along with a handful of other talented, yeah, actually very, like, Paula Pell used to be like a head, yes, SNL writer and a whole bunch of people. Then you're acting in every scene of it with everyone from Helen Mirren to Megan Thee Stallion.
Yeah.
I guess for you, what was the experience like? And also in the grand scheme of things, if you could snap your fingers, even before the TikTok videos, if somebody said, like, what would be the greatest landing place? Would it be like, I want to be at SNL, or I want to have my own series, or so just what it was like doing this and what the ultimate would actually be?
It was very fast paced. And I have to give a shout out to the set designer too. All that set that JC Molina was able to put together was amazing. It was just so, I flew, that was the first time I flew in COVID, you know, to LA, stayed there for 6 weeks, and I'm on set with Jane Lynch one day and John Hamm the next day, and Helen Mirren and I were rehearsing on Zoom, and she was lip syncing, and she was not great at it at first, but then got very good at it, very, very good at it. And she was having so much fun when we actually shot that. She actually came up with, like, the towel snapping that we were doing when we were doing the bus scene. So for me, it was just like, put one foot in front of the other, and you know what I mean? Like, cause it's Helen, she's a dame, you know, I still can't believe that I was able to do that. So it was just a very surreal, like, if I stop to think about what's happening right now, I might pass out. So I better not even think about it and just keep going. That's how it felt. And I think my ultimate goal is to have my own series and to be like the guy that saw that first video, Jerry Seinfeld, one of my, you know, favorite comedians. I watch Seinfeld like every night. And it's one of my favorites. And so I kind of want to take this character of, you know, a blowhard and ask, what if a black woman was a blowhard? You know, like, yeah, that would be a fun thing to do. So it's kind of one of my goals.
Well, I was going to say, I hope that you do the on camera as well as the writing, because I saw with this CBS thing that we talked about, that I think you were only going to be writing. I mean, you need to be on camera. You're that's part of what I thought you were great with. But so and the reason to put out this Netflix thing right before the election, you know, I guess you could have theoretically not had to rush as fast as you guys did, but did you feel that it would hopefully have some impact on the election, or that's when the interest would be greatest in, you know, if Trump lost, or just what was the thought process with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were all praying that he lost, and because there was, you know, Trump content in there, I think that, you know, the interest would be greater, you know, while he was still in office and in power. In his head, he's still in power now, so I guess
that
goes away. But there was that, and then there was also, like, yeah, like, can we get more people engaged and understanding, like, how serious this and how much of an idiot this guy is? You know, if more people understand it, then maybe they'll actually go out and vote. And so I'm hoping that we wanted to have some kind of impact with that as well.
Sure. All right. So with the last minute, I hope I can just give you a few, like, almost rapid fire, big picture, but just what your take is. So if you had never gone on TikTok to lip sync Trump ever, and life had just gone on as it had been going, would you have been content, or was something always ultimately going to give? Like, were you going to have to, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, would you have been okay with just spending the rest of your life at the level of performing work that you were getting up to that point?
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of in 2019, at the end of 2019, I wrote a journal where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. This isn't going anywhere. So I was going to actually go back to Google or try to get another job at the end of 2019. And so I am guessing that's probably where I'd be right now, is at another full-time job. So, and, you know, performing on the side, writing on the side, and that's probably what I would be doing now. And yeah, I mean, I think I'd be okay with that. I mean, maybe I wouldn't get to meet you, Scott.
No, it's a treat for me. So, all right. So here's another side of that question. So your parents, who understandably had encouraged you to do the responsible thing, go get your practical degrees and all of that. What do they make of everything that's happened in the last year?
They're really proud and impressed and surprised. My dad has started a little library of all my little newspaper clippings and, you know, magazine articles and things like that. They're, you know, they're really excited for me because I'm actually doing what I love right now. And I never thought I would be able to do that. To be able to be paid to write, to make people laugh, is just a dream come true that I never thought would happen. So yeah, I think they're just really happy that I'm happy.
That's awesome. And then finally, I do get the sense that, you know, you're not itching to do another Trump lip syncing video. But is there any scenario in which you would? Is there something that could get you to put back on the uniform?
I think it's just one of those things where, like, I have to prove to myself that there's something else I can do and be successful at. And then once that happens, I'll probably lip sync Trump all the time again. You know what I mean? Like, just because it's a fun thing to do. But I can't, right now it's like, no, I have to separate myself and put a little distance and, like, make something else. And then once I do that, then maybe it'll be this fun little thing that I can do every once in a while. And I would have no trouble doing it. I am not saying, though, that I want him to be elected ever again.
Right.
Ever again. So let's make that clear. Yeah.
Well, I thank you for all the entertainment and for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott. This was so much fun.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/Scott Feinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.